So we are in 2 Kings chapter 12. Open up with a prayer if you don't mind. Almighty God, our Father in heaven, thank you for your wisdom and your love of each of us. We ask you, Father, you will be with us today, that your words will flow, that your way be known. That is not our will or our ideas, but they are strictly from you, to teach us and instruct us to follow what we must follow. Bless us and help us to understand. In Yeshua's name, amen. We're in 2 Kings chapter 12. In case you don't remember some of the details of what's happened up to this point, I know it's been a while since I've been up here. Jeff was so kind to fill in for my illness previously. So up to this point, Joash, of course, has become the king of Judah at 7 years old. He is anointed king, of course, the death of Athaliah. Death of Athaliah by killing from Jehoiada's men, the men of Israel, of course, killed her. After she had murdered all of her grandsons, grandchildren, all the descendants of Amaziah, her son, who was killed by Jehu. So we are in 2 Kings chapter 12, picking up the story as Jehoash, or Joash, depending on how it's spelled in different places, different times throughout his life, as he is taking his reign or taking over and deciding what he's going to do as the new youngest king of Israel. Of Judah. My chapters, of course, started with verse 1, chapter 12. So I will begin in verse 21, chapter 11. Jehoash, who was 7 years old when he became king. In the 7th year of Jehu, Jehoash became king, and he reigned for 40 years in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Zibah of Beersheba. Jehoash did what was right in the sight of the Lord all the days in which Jehoiada the priest instructed him. But the high places were not taken away. The people still sacrificed and burned incense on the high places. Jehoash said to the priests, all the money of the dedicated gifts that are brought into the house of the Lord, each man's census money, each man's assessment money, all the money that a man proposes in his heart to bring into the house of the Lord, let the priests take it for themselves, each from his constituency. Let him repair the damages of the temple, wherever any dilapidation is found. Now it was so, by the 23rd year of King Joash, that the priests had not repaired the damages of the temple. So King Joash called Jehoiada the priest and the other priests and said to them, why have you not repaired the damages of the temple? Now therefore, do not take more money from your constituency, but deliver it for repairing the damages of the temple. And the priests agreed that they would neither receive more money from the people nor repair the damages of the temple. Then Jehoiada the priest took a chest, bored a hole in it, in the lid, set it beside the altar on the right side as one comes into the house. Of the house of the Lord. And the priests who kept the door put there all the money brought into the house of the Lord. So it was, whenever they saw that there was much money in it, the chest, that the king's scribe and the high priest came up and put it in bags, counted the money that was found in the house of the Lord. Then they gave the money which had been apportioned to the hands of those who did the work, who had the oversight of the house of the Lord and had paid out to the carpenters and builders who worked in the house of the Lord, and to the masons, the stone cutters, and for buying timber and hewn stone to repair the damage of the house of the Lord, and for all that was paid out to repair the damages. Repair the temple. However, there was not made for the house of the Lord basins of silver, trimmers, sprinkling bowls, trumpets, any articles of gold or silver, from the money brought into the house of the Lord. But they gave that to the workmen, and they repaired the house of the Lord with it. Moreover, they did not require an account from the men in whose hand they delivered it to be paid. The workmen, for they dealt faithfully. The money from the trespass offerings and the money from the sin offerings was not brought into the house of the Lord. It belonged to the priests. And Hazael, king of Syria, went and fought against Gath, and took it. Then Hazael set his face to go up to Jerusalem. Joash, king of Judah, took all the sacred things that his fathers, Jehoshaphat, and Jehoram and Ahaziah, kings of Judah, had dedicated, and his own sacred things, and all the gold found in the treasuries of the house of the Lord and the king's house, sent them to Hazael, king of Syria. Then he went away from Jerusalem. Now the rest of the acts of Joash, and all that he did, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Judah? And his servants arose and formed a conspiracy, and killed Joash in the house of Milo, which goes down to Selah. For Yozachar, the son of Shemeath, and Jehoshaphat, the son of Shomer, his servants struck him. So he died. And they buried him with his fathers in the city of David. Then Amaziah, his son, reigned in his place. That was 2 Kings, chapter 13. Sorry, 12, sorry. No, 13, 36 time. Chapter 12. Any questions or comments around this particular chapter I can answer for you? Yes, Sean.
Verse 18, is there something going on here where he took the sacred things of his father and his own sacred things?
Yes. What specifically about them? What's your question regarding it?
Is he mixing something holy and unholy?
He collected all these sacred items. So, for example, you have temple utensils in some cases, anything that was dedicated to God's purpose, any of the tools of that nature that would be used that are of metal value, like gold, silver, coins, whatever, all those items that were collected in the house of the Lord, he took them all and handed them over. Yes, Deborah.
Okay, he said he was at 7 years old.
Correct.
When he began to reign.
Yes.
At 7 years old, in their era, they were pretty bright, huh? I'm wondering. Well, I don't know. Micah's so. Six. My grandson's six. He can read, but I didn't have reasoning. But I'm wondering, what's that mean? Is seven mean something else then, huh?
No, no. He was 7 years old, but we'll discuss that. Actually, I drew this picture last time I was up here. I'll draw it up again. I dropped that marker. I knew it. I'll draw this picture again. It was a simple one, but it made sense to me. So as I drew a picture of a little tree that was broken off, a little branch. So the temple of God, we'll make this the temple of God. It's a square, sort of rectangular shape. Little tiny bush growing in there. Who's the bush? Well, little tiny bush would be Joash. He was literally severed off of his family line as an infant. He was trained in the temple of God, lived there for 6+ years, raising, being grown up, and only taught about what God wanted. So what his intelligence capacity is, it's reasonably high. Not say he's, a brain child, but it's reasonably high. I won't say he's perfect, but he's better off. So he's over here in God's house when he was being raised and grown up. And it says he did everything that was right as during the years of Jehoiada, the high priest, because the high priest is the one who raised him. So God's cutting off of David's line of the, not every relative, but rather of the kingly line descendants when he killed because Ahab's, had contaminated his line, if I use that term. Ahab contaminated it, so God had killed everybody that Ahab was associated with, but he couldn't neglect the agreement with David, so he took an infant off that line that would have no knowledge of his background, really, because infants don't really have knowledge of their background. They know, obviously, hey, you were descendant of so-and-so, blah, 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 but was not raised in it, and brought him over to God's house and re-raised him. And we discussed this last time, and it was a very, very symbolic of Messiah in his nature, what he was doing, how Messiah was essentially a descendant of David, of the royal line, but raised in God's house. Messiah lived God's life as far as the way God wanted it lived. And Joash did the same thing. He was a messianic figure in this way. He did, of course, for 7 years. So he was raised there. His knowledge of what God wanted was based upon Jehoiada's understanding of what he taught him, the high priest. The high priest was very smart, did a good job, examined and knew the people of Judah and how they manipulated one another. And he knew the queen well enough to be able to teach the son properly. So his intelligence, he was in fact 7 years old when he took over. He is not the only person in the palace. He is not by himself. There are advisors, there are people there, and most likely Jehoiada the high priest would be either not a direct advisor, but at least associated with the boy for the remainder of his youth growing up. Because he raised him for the last six and a half years. He's going to raise him and continue on helping him along the way. Which that's what he did. Now this whole event with the temple, although it does not specify when exactly the order was given, like how old he was when he gave the order to repair the temple, it does say when he was 23 years old.
Or 23 years later, I should double check that. Let's see here. Oh, 23rd year. So he's 30 years old, roughly. 30 years old, the temple was not repaired yet. And there's a reason why he's 30, but we'll discuss that shortly. Yes. He's filling a messianic prophecy. Any questions or comments regarding this so far? Yes.
Raised with I can't pronounce the name.
Jehoiada.
Thank you. If he was raised with him, shouldn't he have known that when he took his position as king, that the high places needed to come down immediately?
You'd think so, huh? The high places. We're going to discuss that. He is a human being, though. He's not a perfect individual. Yes, see, there are certain things he should have known and would have should have done, but he did not do all of them. We're going to discuss some of those details of high places, though. There's more detail in them than just that. Any questions or comments so far? Okay. Oh, yes.
What is the census money that they collected? What was that all about?
Tax, essentially. It's a head tax.
So the priests collected taxes from the people?
Sort of. Censuses were not done very often. Okay. But censuses did happen occasionally. God did not want a census done very often, actually virtually never. But occasionally it did happen. When you did have to take a census, according to the Torah, you had to pay. The individual had to pay for themselves to be counted. So, for example, if you said, I want to count how you go to the room, and I go through counting them, each one of you would have to give me a certain dollar amount, or shekel, maybe what, half shekel? There's half shekel. Was it half or a full? Half, yeah. For each one of you would have to pay in a bucket a half shekel, and I would count, not you, I would count the half shekels. So I wouldn't be counting you as the head, or the person. I'd be counting half shekel. And the point is, God does not want a census taken. He doesn't want the kings or the government to know how many people are under them or not. That's not the point. God doesn't want them to think or focus upon numbers. Because men or kings who trust in numbers get themselves in a lot of trouble. They tend to go to battle.
Well, yes. How come they did other repairs, but it seems like making the silver basins, the trimmers, and the sprinkling bowls. Why wouldn't that be taken care of when that's part of his utensils and stuff? Isn't that real important?
It is important. Let's see here. You're going into a conceptual idea, which I would like to talk about, but I don't know if I can talk about it today. It has to do with what is a person and their identity and a member of the temple of God, and how those utensils were not made by money, but rather made by people. But I don't think we'll get into that today. It's a complicated topic. Any questions or comments I can answer for you? Okay. Now, I mentioned before, I left all my notes at home, so I'm going through this by memory, so forgive me. Let's see, I have written up here, those of you cannot read it from where you're at, a question says, what method does Messiah use to clean God's house? Okay, well, we just read it. What method, cords and whips, not exactly. What method did Joash, who I didn't do it, choose? What was his first task when he became king? We don't know how many years went by, but I shouldn't say first task, but the first one that's recorded here in this particular chapter. He collects the priests together with Jehoiada. This is all the money dedicated, the gifts that belong, brought to the house of the Lord. Each man's census money, the man's assessment money, the money that the man proposes in his heart to give the Lord, into the house of the Lord. The priests take it for themselves, each from his constituency. Let them repair damages, the temples, and whatever, develop their things. What did he just command them to do? I'm going to erase this. collect the money. Anybody read the Torah? What rules are there for money collection and high priests? Well, it's not a Shabbat, that's true. What is the details of who gets to keep the money? Who's it belong to? Look for the priests. It's theirs. So what actually is Yehoiada doing, Yoash doing when he's commanding them to collect all the money? Now, he does single out sin money, and this other with two that does not get collected. It stays in the priest's hand. What's he doing? He's saying all the money which you normally collect for sacrifices. Now, those who don't recall, let's say, for example, you commit a sin, or not sin, sorry, that's sin money. You dedicate something to God, whatever it means, a bull or calf or ram, whatever makes a difference. It makes a difference. Is that a money object or an animal object? It's an animal object. So where does the money come from it? Okay. Does somebody buy it? Ah, there is a redeeming option. All this money, by the way, the Torah commands you to come forth and bring forth their animal offerings. There's grain offerings. There's those details. There was no, hey, here's a dollar offering. No, isn't saying, okay, you know, God, I don't have a cow this week, or I guess it'd be a bull. I have a bull this week to offer you, so instead, here's, what do bulls go for now? What, a couple of grand? Here's $2,000 or $3,000, whatever it might be, dollars instead. Does the Torah say that? No, it does not. Go ahead. Right. That's the money comes from. Recall where Solomon's temple, how big Solomon's temple was? Really, really big. It had walls, the outside, inner courtrooms, and a whole bunch of courts all over the place, all separated out. All these were three-story building with rooms inside the walls, I mean, a top-down view. What exists on the first floor, all the way down? Storage. And who's maintaining the storage? Priests are. What are they storing? Grain, animals, property, things which you offer or give, also money, everything that says treasure offered to give in the temple of the Lord. So let's say, for example, you, Joe Schmo, no one named Joe Schmo here, you come from, let's say it's not really far away from Israel. You come from Nebraska. That's a far away. So you come from Nebraska, you speak probably some Indian language. You come from Nebraska. Did you bring your cow with you or your bull with you?
No.
Bummer. Sorry, go home. Take the money with you and buy it while you're there. Who are you going to buy it from? The priests. Now, why do you deprive the priests? Well cared for, typically, but the priests were allotted in the Torah. The region, pretend this is the temple, but I'm now outside of Jerusalem. All the area, the lands, outside the cities. And what was the Torah told them they could do with that land? They could support their livelihood, including the animals that were brought in, or whatever, to bring them and maintain this cycle of process. The reason... Crops, and in Negro, there was in the region surrounding the city only. Not far out, but nearby. So if you're Joe Schmo from Nebraska, and you come out and say, hey, I couldn't bring my cow here, it didn't fit on the boat. It's a small boat. I come here, and I need to make an offering. Well, where do I get the offering from? And the priest says, well, we have X number of animals here, what's your offering type, here's the rules about what you're doing. Okay, here are your selections, go choose which offering you want. Okay, thanks. Here's the money to pay for it. That's where the money comes from. So there, I'm going to put a little dollar sign up here in this corner. I'm sure it's really not that particular corner of the temple, but we'll just pretend it is. That's where I decided to put it. So, they put all the money here, as people come in and buy not just animals, they can buy grain products, they can buy anything they want in order to offer it to God. That is the same method that every pagan temple does too. It's no different. It's the same process because typically when you're traveling to a temple for a long distance, you don't bring all your stuff with you. You could. Most people can't afford to bring all their stuff. They carry their funds or money with them because that's easy to carry. There's a reason why you use a money system instead of a barter system anymore. It's hard to say, hey, I'll, you know, haul all my cattle up to trade for your, you know, bucket of honey. You're like, well, I don't want the cattle, I'll take the money instead. So there's a reason why you use money instead of barter system. So that's a process. So they're going to collect money there. But he gave them one more stipulation. In verse 5, let the priests take it for themselves, each from his constituency. What's a constituency? Your people. Well, what people is that?
His tribe?
Not exactly tribe, because they're all from Levi. Okay. They're friends. They're friends. Yeah, if you're voting, it'd be your people who vote for you. It's the same principle. It's from where you're at, your friends and acquaintances. So what do the priests have to actually go out and do? So let's all scatter, leave the temple, go out to where all of our houses are of our little friends. Hey, buddies, we need some money. Go to the houses, go to your friends, ask for it. That's what the king is telling them to do. Ask for it. Not just the money that comes in here, directly from the random people coming through, but also go out and ask for money. Yeah. That's not commonly done. And how successful were they? Let's see. 23 years later, they still don't have enough money. So were the priests successful collecting all the money? If they were, they didn't use it. What's the other? Well, you could think that, and it's not necessarily wrong because that's normally what they usually did. That was their income source. But what's the other detail the king gave them? He gave them one other task with inside this constituency rule. Right, so who repairs it? Priests. The king said the priests repair the temple. So why would the king even think such a thing? Well, who is allowed to go into the temple? Yeah. As Tammy, I'm sure, is going to bring out. Who's allowed to go inside? Only the priests. Well, so who gets to build it? The priests. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, I wouldn't think a warfare could go into the holy.
Right, only the priests get to go there. Right, but by the time Joash shows up, this whole building is sacred.
So
keep in mind that when Solomon built the temple, the sacred section was here, where the Holy of Holies was, the immediate area in front of it, which is where altars and things like that were located at, that was the, quote, sacred section. The holy place that only the high priest got to go, and maybe a few of the priests immediately preceding it. The rest of the regions were for more common individuals, not unclean. I don't get rid of the word common being unclean. I mean common meaning not necessarily high priest's family, but actually other individuals. It could be priests, but males typically. Males typically. Now, women can go into in certain circumstances, but males typically. So it would go in this region. But the rest of this wall area was not. That's normal commerce. Do what you need to do. Get your business done. Nothing holy about it. So, but by the time Jehoiada is the high priest and Joash shows up, that's not the case anymore. They took this whole place as theirs. All of it being holy. Which means who got to come in? Just priests went in. And any males they allowed in the courtyard area, which they allowed certain individuals, in this case, typically it was leader heads of family or tribes, that kind of thing. They would also allow, they did allow the Levites changing of guard. Now, don't get me wrong, my drawing scale here is very not to scale. It's a very big building, it's not quite so small as I'm showing it here. So it's very large, many people could fit inside of it. But it's becoming a holy place. So when Joash shows up and is desirous to follow God's will as best he can, who gets to go inside here? Well, only the high priest, only the priesthood does. The Levites do. Typically. So that's the case that's going on. So who gets to repair it? Only they can. Can workmen do so? Only if you have to be from a Levite priest family. Otherwise, no, you can't. So you don't. 23 years go by. The shambles. They don't fix it. Not only that, there's one other detail which I did not point out to you, but was disclosed in chapter 11. every single week. Actually, I think Jeff talked to us last week. Every single week. Wow, I'm going to write it down. The Levites change guards. So all the stuff you've been doing, that you did for a week, you stop. And you go move on. You have, I think it's 2 weeks off. I think it's 2 weeks off. No, I didn't double check my figures. I believe they serve once a week, always. One full week. They serve that for one full week. The change of the guards, if I remember correctly, David had it set up, it was every 12 weeks? So every 12 sections, sets, they were, a new group would come in. Now, it's not to say that one individual who was not of a particular family could not go in multiple groups, but it was broken up that way. So they serve 2 weeks a year, roughly. Because they have 12 weeks, reset again, 12 weeks, so, 24? 24, sorry, that doesn't sound right. Every 24 weeks. Sorry, so one person would serve at least once every 24 weeks, and then of course also, and then once again another 24 weeks, so it's a full year. So you are there at least twice a year. How much work have you done in 2 weeks out of the year? Very little. Not only that, let's say your job was this corner over here in this room. Repair that room. So you come in, you do your job, oh, I did it from here, and I did this little corner in my week. Next guy shows up, you know what, I don't like the way you did it. I'm going to do it this way. Next, you guys are all crazy. It shouldn't be squares, it should be circles. Yeah. I'm not saying that they did, I'm saying that's what can happen. So, you're going to go against each other because you're not there all the time, you're not one man doing it. Now, after 23 years, nothing's done. So it comes along and says, okay, stop. The king orders a complete ending of this process. It's not working for him. 23 years, he collects the priests, he brings the priests back to him. He calls Jehoiada the high priest and says, why is this not done so? You've not finished simple. Now he says, do not, in verse 7, take any more money from your constituency. Stop asking for money. That's what he's telling him to do. But deliver it for the repair of the damage to the temple. The priests agreed they would neither receive more money from the temple nor repair the damages. So, the king just said, you're all fired. Don't do any of the work. You do your job of collecting funds, taking care of the sacrifices, don't do anything past that. Let workers take the rest of the job. So, 23 years go by, they finally get this job done. So, that's why it's pretty simple, basically straightforward. He's foregoing the rule of only priests being the job or doing the work inside of it. So, I have a question. I'm sorry, what was that?
Well, what's
going to
happen if the chief disobeys and sends a bunch of people in there? Won't they all go
not
in?
No. Keep in mind, what does God say is holy? The little square in here. That's what God said was holy.
Oh, I see.
But King Uzziah finds it out the hard way. That's God's... What's the spot here?
That's clean.
Right. Well, don't be dirty yourself. But any person is allowed to be there as long as they are a clean individual. It could be a priest. It could be a non-priest. As long as they're outside God's space, he's okay with that. Right. These are all the outer court sections. Gentiles could go there if they're a clean individual. So they have to be a clean person. They have to be ritually clean, extra clean. So all the dust area is fine. It's the only place high priests have to repair is the Holy of Holies. How much damage do the Holy of Holies receive? How many times do priests go in there?
Once a year.
Once a year. So is it really any damage likely inside that? Probably not. Things can wear out, but everything on the inside was covered with gold on the inside. And gold is not a tarnishing item, typically. So the likelihood of anything decomposing is almost zero. Almost. Yes, Alma.
Wouldn't pure gold melt? Or, you know, like, sag?
If it was hot, it wasn't done well, you're right, it could. But keep in mind, we think of pure gold as 24 karat. Like, it's pure, pure gold. That is not necessarily the pure gold that we define as pure here, pure, modern day. It's not necessarily defined modern day pure then. So, keep in mind, for example, let's say, for example, they are mining gold, or they actually would have bought it first, because it wasn't any gold in Israel, they'd mine it. You mine gold from some other city, whatever, some other town, bring it in. What level of purity is that gold? No, it's has, if you've ever found it mining gold, it's mixed with a whole bunch of metal. It's not just gold. It's many things. It looks like gold. It's soft like gold, but it could be 20 carat. It could be 22 carat. It could be 10. All the different quality of gold comes in. Now, when Solomon was king and doing the best he can to collect all this stuff, I'm sure he used relatively good quality gold when he made all this stuff, the interior of the Holy of Holies and everything else. But the likelihood of being pure gold is pretty slim because that takes a lot of refining to do. Even modern-day technology doesn't always get it. Sometimes we still can't do it right. Certain golds we cannot refine good enough to be 24 carats, so we don't bother. And we can't do it now with a lot of very well-designed furnaces. Them is very slim. They could have refined things that well all the time. So whatever gold he used, by the way, it was also an overlay too. So it wasn't just a block of gold. It was overlaid on a structural item. So, for example, when we would discuss the building of Solomon's Temple, he had two doors. He bought a lot of doors. There were two cherubim he made of olive wood on inside the Holy of Holies. They're sitting back here in the back. Erase my little thing here. I'm a little, I don't know what cherub looks like. We'll just, but he had wings. Looks kind of like a termite flying. But anyway, it has wings, all right? So the wings are supposed to be touching each other here, and they're above the ark with its poles sticking through. These cherubim are solid olive wood. I should say solid. They are made of olive wood. Olive wood is quite a big, but it's very, very large. He overlaid them with gold, which means gold is the outside. So where does the structure come from? The wood. Now, all the walls here were also, I think they were not hewn stone, but they were stone. But there was that type of wood, I can't remember what the top of it is. Those also covered the walls were also laid with wood. There was stone on one side, then they put walls up, wooden walls, and then they laid those with gold as well. So where's the structure? The wood still. So, all this, the gold that's in here is all an overlay. So even if it was the purest form of gold we can find, which is relatively soft and it does sag under its own weight, being a very thin overlay off of something else, it's getting all of its strength from whatever it's overlaying. So it's getting strength from the wood or from wood, rock components, whatever happens to be overlaid. That's most of its strength. Being that way, and a complete overlay, can bugs get into the wood? No, not only the bugs have to start out there, otherwise they aren't. So the wood's going to stay pretty clean. The metal protects it, and the metal doesn't decompose or tarnish really. So the Holy of Holy area is pretty clean. Now, I don't know if all the stuff existed still, because the temple's been ransacked a couple times now. Yes, Tammy.
I'm going to change the subject here a little bit. You were saying earlier that by the time Jehoash becomes king, that the priests had pretty much decided that the whole temple was only a place the priests could go, or had designated the whole thing as holy, and they didn't want anybody else to
I shouldn't have said
in.
The whole thing. There's all the courts, actually. I should have said the entire walls. All the courts were designated for a holy section.
Yeah. So if you think about it, though, why would they do that? Well, one reason is that even though the northern tribes of Israel were incredibly corrupt in their worship, you know, for the most part, a lot of those kings of Judah were not that much better.
No, they weren't.
You kind of would wonder what percentage of the population would have been really on Yahweh's side and be willing to maintain that ritual purity as non-priests to enter in? I would have a feeling not very many.
That's a good point.
And
that's
so
a good point.
The priests, well, no one's coming here anyway, so we'll just keep this all for
ourselves.
Seal it all off. That's a good point.
Expounding that just slightly on what Tammy just points out. I'm going to erase my little section up here because I don't need it right now. Ah, my last little house hats. So by the time Yoash is, he's 7 years old, he's 200 years after. Tell what year it is in BC. I can't remember the year. It's got to be about 750 BC, somewhere in that range. Basically, he's looking about roughly 200 years after Solomon's reign that he's showing up on the scene. So after 200 years, Northern tribe has long since dilapidated to nothing really of godly per se, although Elisha is still there and they're still working with it. Judah is on its way downhill as well. How many people are pure or ritually clean, you should say, in Judah? In Judah alone. Not just Israel, but in Judah. Compared to the country of Judah, compared to what it was in Solomon's time. Probably less. Probably less, because there's more pagan gods things showing up. So how many visitors did the temple get? Probably less than they did in Solomon's time. They're doing other things, visiting other gods, other things they want to do. So if I was a foreigner, meaning I may or may not be of Judah, but I have no knowledge of God, this whole temple, I'm not allowed in. I'm not. I am unholy, unclean. They're going to stop me at the gate. There's actually a gate here. There's three on each side. So me, being an outsider, having no knowledge of God, I see, oh, look, there are guards at each of these gates, and they won't let me in. But the priests get to go in. Thus, the whole thing must be holy. In my perspective, the whole building is holy. It's not that. It's because I'm just so horribly contaminated. I'm not allowed in. Yes.
Could this also be the reason why they had a hard time getting money from constituents?
It could be. It's hard to get money from people who, who aren't that many. They can't go in. Okay, let's move on, though. It could be. It could be the reason, because there aren't that many. And also, constituency, if you're going to ask for money, you ask for money with somebody who has money to give it. Yeah, exactly. You have to believe in the same philosophy or want the same desire. Even though the king did order it, it doesn't necessarily mean everybody's going to obey. Let's move on a little bit further. So they changed the rules. The priests aren't going to do the repair work. Workmen are. They can do everything except, of course, God's holy section inside the Holy of Holies, which is probably in good condition anyway. He does all this. Great and wonderful. What's his idea? What's his plan? To avoid the suspicion that the priests themselves are either skimming off the top or collecting the funds and not turning it all over the temple, he, of course, has this whole chest with the bore drilled in. Smart idea. So there are men, obviously the priests, most likely, probably a king's official occasionally as well, hanging out at the gates. You know, I don't know that everyone's allowed in every single gate. So I do not know if they just sealed off certain gates, or certain gates are for certain individuals to come through only, or not. But at least whatever the main gate or main common way of coming in, there was a box nearby it. Now, it's not just there, because in Chronicles it records a box here. Well, a box here. I'm pretending this is the gate they choose. It also records a box at the altar, which is over here. That would imply there's at least two boxes. One for people coming in the temple, and one for people making an offering. So you come in the temple and not necessarily make an offering. You might be coming to pray, whatever reason, who knows. You can offer here your gift or your offering, whatever it may be. Another one who is making an offering can actually go over here and put it in that box as well, either both or one at a time. It makes a difference. There's at least two. There might be a whole bunch of them, one at every single gate. I don't know. But there's at least two.
If offering privately, let no one see. You can do it there, because you don't want to do that.
Right. You could do it. Here, because only the priest, you had to physically hand it to the priest official who was standing there with the box. Take it from your hand and put it into the box. So that individual knows how much you've given to do so. Now, I don't know if that's the case for both boxes or not, but that is at least the case for one of these two boxes. And then, of course, the king official and the high priest comes and count the funds inside the box. Doesn't matter. Yeah, they don't know who it's from. It's unknown. Let's move on, though. I can move a little faster. Oh, yes. You had a question?
No.
Oh. That's fine. By the way, when I'm coming through this, think of yourself. That's so funny. Think of yourself during this process on how you respond or think or act. So let me erase this. Forgive me, I don't need it picture anymore. Yes, I killed the picture. Yes, you can draw with me. I'm an active drawer. Yeah, I like to draw. I do it for a living, I should.
You're just tired on the weekend, right? Every weekend is hard.
Yeah, yep. Okay. So the outside building gets to have workers, carpenters, they get to go inside and work around the whole temple. Why is this allowed? Now, we mentioned before, the Holy of Holies was the section that was actually important that not anybody could go into. Who built the temple originally? Solomon. Now, who did he hire to do the work? Some were foreigners. Foreigners did the outside work. Judah did the inside work. So, for example, let's put a mountaintop here. We'll say Jerusalem's there in Israel. A little map. So Jerusalem's here. Where was the cut-hewn stone from? The mountains over here, far away. So no one could hear it. Now, where is the wood from? Way up here in Lebanon. Little tree. Trees look like arrows, but they're up there. They brought in trees from Lebanon through Joppa, which I think is somewhere around here. And they brought it up. They brought the trees to Jerusalem. All the stone was cut out here by workers, foreigners. Did the work. They want all the cutting here. They want a chisel herd in Jerusalem. So who got to build and assemble the temple itself? No, foreigners didn't assemble the temple. Although they did part of it. They assembled some of the wall. They assembled the wall. Judah did. Or Israel, actually. But Judah did. Are Judah meaning, does that mean only priests? No, it means the workers who were actually of Judah. The whole tribe, with the line here, although Israel wasn't a separate country at the time, all the people that actually built the temple, though they were collecting the items from foreigners, they were actually citizens, not priests. So they built it. If they built it then in Solomon's time, they can certainly build it again during Joash's time. Hence, why only the Holy of Holies is sacred. The rest of it is not. Now, when Solomon was building it, the Holy of Holies did not contain the Ark of the Covenant yet. It was outside, in a different location. It was waiting until it was all built before he brought it in. But that's what they were doing. So that's how Joash is able to do so, because the man who built the temple to begin with did so. Because you know on the line, well, why not? I don't have to have priests only do this. I can have, obviously, workers do it too. So he collects money, he pays the workers and carpenters with all the money. Why doesn't he build utensils? Why does he not build utensils?
Did they use all the money for the workers?
He did use the money for the workers, except the money for sin in particular, and a few other offerings were strictly by law, Torah law, given to the priesthood only. You can't touch that, it's their income. He didn't make any trumpets, any articles of silver or gold. From all the money bought in the house, because they gave all the money to the workmen. So he couldn't restore the temple to Solomon, to Solomon's level, because utensils couldn't be done. He couldn't finish it off. Didn't have enough funds. Not enough money there to do it. What did he do with the money that did come in that wasn't spent on the workers? Let's say, for example, you have money coming in. Let's pretend, just pretend, you bring, instead of gold, you bring a gem. Some rock, whatever. Choose whatever one you want. Fine. Bring one in, can that be hammered into a utensil? Can that be modified in any significant way to be a trimmer of any object at all? No. Not much. You can save it, you can sell it if you wished to. But some of these items cannot physically be brought into gold ability or utensil ability. Some of them, obviously, as gems could be theoretically paid to workers, but they were probably paying the workers on a weight-based value of metal versus gems. So you can bring a lot of stuff in there. So all this stuff, we'll just put, dollar signs up here for all this very stuff. I'm sure they didn't use dollars, but whatever they use, the shekel sign. I'm sure the shekel sign looks like. I'd write that up if I knew. They used those, but all the things that didn't come in, what did he do with it? Well, he holds on to it until Hazael, verse 17. He went a step too far. He's holding on the money, which is fine, nothing wrong with that. He didn't finish the work he did, which means there's still money there
But he didn't use it to build the utensils. Possibly could have, but he didn't. He could have sold the gems, as I was pointing out before, and used that money to build the trumpets or whatever else he wanted. He didn't do that. He held on to it. And Hazael, I'm going to draw another map here, a bigger one. So Gath is somewhere around here along the coastline. Jerusalem's around here. Syria, which Hazael is from, is over here. Draw the line of roughly about here, a little loop here, because this is the Philistine territory. The PH for Philistines. Israel's up top, and Judah is down here on the bottom. Hazael, for the last few years, ever since Jehu and Jehu's sons and descendants, has been picking off sections of Israel, northern tribes, take off territory and regions. Remember, who was Hazael? Yeah, how did he get to become king? He did kill someone. What was the specific command given to Elijah that Elisha performed regarding Hazael? To anoint him as king of Syria. Hazael is God's anointed king.
What's his name?
Hazael. I don't know. Hazael. I don't know what that's his name. It's a person. I don't know what it would be. So Hazael, he is the anointed king of Syria. He is God's anointed king. And I would not think that, a pagan being anointed king, but it happens occasionally. He's God's anointed king by Elisha to be king of Syria. Hazael at the time, of course, was a servant of Ben-Hadad. And Ben-Hadad was ill, and Hazael was sent to go talk to Elisha to ask if Ben-Hadad would recover from his illness. And Elisha said Ben-Hadad should, use the word very carefully, should recover. But he says, you, Hazael, are now going to be king of Israel, of Syria. Can anything undo that? Can anything undo an anointed king of God? Yep, only God can. So what's Hazael's command? Well, as Elisha tells him, you are going to kill and maim and murder all the people of Israel. Not all, but there's not a number of them. So guess what he does? Kills, maims, murders all of Israel. He's going through a rampage. He literally takes out huge sections. He's all the way down here to Gath. Joash, does he know of Elijah and Elisha's anointment of Hazael? He's a kid at the time. Most likely not. Most of not, because Elisha was a king, was a prophet of Israel. Elijah was also a prophet of Israel. Both men were old by the time Joash becomes king. Well, actually, Elijah was gone. But Elisha was an old man. Still alive, an old man by the time Joash becomes king. His knowledge of what happens in Israel and what those men were doing and who they anointed happened more during Jehoshaphat, Joash's grandfather, during his lifetime. So those men did all this work. Not so much in Joash. So as time Joash shows up, his knowledge of Hazael, all he sees is he's unstoppable. Look, he went through all of Israel and took out huge chunks, killed off, wiped off their army, left a very small army sitting here in Samaria, which is pathetically tiny. It was only enough to just defend the city. He killed all these men and these women. And he's in Gath, and now he's looking facing Jerusalem. So what does Joash see? He sees an unstoppable force. And clearly, God is not stopping him. So that's where he has fear. It's too bad that that's what he feared. Because Hazael was anointed to be ruler and cause damage to Israel. Elisha did not anoint him to cause any damage to Judah. Joash doesn't know that.
Is Joash in Judah?
Yes. He doesn't know that. He doesn't know that Elisha and Elijah, that Elisha's prophecy or anointment of Hazael was what he was going to do to the women and children and men of Israel.
So they got attacked because they're disobeying.
Yes. Yes. It was happening during Ahab's lifetime, I believe.
He's almost
when it happened. Joash is approaching 30, or actually he's over 30 now at this point in time. Good question. Good question. As some of his predecessors had done, and some of his successors do, they stop and say, okay, stop. We need to address God, because this is beyond us. Joash doesn't. He makes a decision on his own, which is similar to his decision to leave the high places there, even though he knows better. He makes a decision on his own. He was a boy. He still made some decisions. They weren't necessarily good ones. So instead of saying, okay, Gath's been taken, Hazael's facing Jerusalem. If he's facing Jerusalem, means he's traveling, he's either in this region of Judah. He's traveling toward Jerusalem. Other conquerors have come to Jerusalem before, and some will later on. Some get wiped out. Some don't. Depends on the respectfulness responses of the kings of Judah dictates what happens to these men. So instead of his solution of going straight to the temple and praying to God, saying, okay, God, this is on you, because I don't have an army to defeat. God probably could have taken Hazael and taken him away back home. Because Hazael was never anointed to be ruler or take over chunks of Judah. He was anointed to take chunks of Israel, not Judah. But Joash doesn't know that. Was, yeah, the top part was called Israel, the bottom part was called Judah. That happened during Rehoboam's reign, which is Solomon's son. It was like, I think it's second year?
They divided because of worship.
No, they divided from taxes.
Oh, to make tax.
Well, taxes were the dominant one. Why do you think we had the American Revolution? Taxes.
Is that
speaking? No. It's taxes. Money does amazing things to people. It really does. Money does amazing stuff to people. Solomon was very heavy against the northern tribes because they were not biologically of Judah. But so they were heavily taxed, heavily burdened. And they came to Rehoboam saying, hey, your father's been really mean to us. Can you please release some of this workload? And Rehoboam's advisors who were around during Solomon's time said, listen to them. Obey them. Release their workload. This is too hard on them. But Rehoboam didn't like that idea. He liked his standard of living by taxing everybody else and making lots of money himself. And so he said, no, make your burdens even harder. And that's when he said, okay, now we're dividing, we separated. Similar. So, and then the prophets came and told Rehoboam, hey, this was from God. This was pre-planned. You didn't have a choice in the matter. This happened during Solomon's time and continued all the way through. The pretext, or the straw man used, a straw, was you're taxing us too much. That was the pretext required to make the separation. But realistically, God was working on it all along. So there's Judah, from that point on, from Rehoboam's time on, there was Judah and there was Israel. Judah did contain a number of other tribe members. They weren't only Judah, because when that happened, a number of people of Israel who believed in God and did not wish to follow the new king of Rehoboam and his methods, they moved down to Judah territory when this division took place. Yes, they didn't wish to come, they would let them come. That was not a problem. But then at the same time, the reverse happened too. Some people came here, didn't like God, and they wanted to follow Israel, so they went up top. So, there was a population exchange. Not a lot, but certain people. So there were more than just Judah down here, there were other tribe members too. But, and they've been there for obviously a couple hundred years, but that's not the only people down, but even though it's called Judah, there were some other members of Israel. So in case this event happens, watch my eraser, in case God says, Israel, I'm going to do away with you, which guess what, that does happen later on, there are members down here, a remnant that still exists, that this didn't happen to. They're still down here. So descendants still exist from each tribe, made it way, still maintained in Judah, even though Israel gets wiped out in 720, I think it's 720, BC. 720? I think it is. I can't remember exactly. I can't remember numbers. Maybe Jeff can catch me. I can't remember the exact year that it happened. Something like that. Judah happens like 586, something like that. 580, 5, 15. Oh, anyway, doesn't matter. So Judah happens later, but so remnants do exist of all tribes still in Judah, as well as remnants exist in all of Israel too. There's a mixture of people. So instead of him trusting God and saying, "Hey, I'm going to do something about this by going to God," he says, "No, I'll go to the money bank, known as the little treasury corner I put up here in God Solomon's temple." I'm not sure it wasn't actually a single corner, but pretend it was. He goes in here and says, "I'm going to collect all this funds. The money I didn't use, the money my father set aside, my grandfather set aside for treasury of God purposes, all that funds that I didn't use to repair the temple with, because that wasn't part of the requirement, any other funds that did not come in to pay the workmen," he collects all that and gives it over to Hazael. What did that earn him? It earned him a death sentence. Yeah, God doesn't take kindly to stealing.
No, and then he gave it to a guy out of fear.
Right, he gave it to a man of fear instead of going straight to God. So Hazael, what did it earn him? It earned him this. His servants, verse 20, arose and formed a conspiracy, killed Joash in the house of Milo, which goes under Selah. Yozachar, the son of Shemeath, and Yehozavad, the son of Shomer, his servant, struck him, so he died. He buried his father in the city of David. Then Amaziah, his son, reigned in his place. He reigned for about 40 years. So he's 47 years old when he dies. That's relatively young. He doesn't get to complete a reign like Solomon. Actually, Solomon died. How old was Solomon? 40 years is still a good reign, but he's 47 years old. He's not an old man. He's still very young. The servants, this is what I like about this part of the story. The servants did something that was wrong. They murdered someone. They murdered an anointed king of God. But you can also tell in chapter 13, when we read chapter 13, though they did something against God's law, they did not necessarily do something against God's will. And that's clued into us. We have that read chapter 13. That Amaziah, when he becomes king, has a dilemma. What do I do with these two servants who have killed my father? Yeah. What do I do with them? Now, many kings... What was that? What was your question? He prays about it. He does something more than just praise. He actually obeys God's will. Because just like David, he does the one thing you're supposed to do when someone commits a crime worthy of punishment or death. You only kill that person. But did it. And Amaziah runs across this at the time, which we didn't read chapter 13 yet. We'll read it next time. He runs across with these two individuals. He knows the law of God says you do not punish the fathers for a son's sin, or vice versa. And they say, okay, although his predecessors and his subsequent followers will kill whole families for a single crime, he obeys this rule. So how well, I must ask you, did Joash teach his son? His son looks at these two men, the two men who killed his father, and makes it a point to only execute those two men, following God's Torah letter. That implies he got instructions either from his mother or from his father, Joash, instructing him what is truly God's will and laws. So although these men who killed his father, Joash, did something against God's law in killing, they were not necessarily going against God's will because their punishment was exactly according to the Torah. Contrast that to Ahab. Now Ahab, all of his sins, they were also against the Torah, but they were equally against God's will too. That is shown by the fact that his punishment was far greater than what the Torah describes. He and his entire descendancy were wiped out for his sins. So, that is, he would not just pass the Torah law, he also passed God's will. You will run across people individually
that appear to contrary go against God's Torah. But that doesn't necessarily mean they're going against God's will. There's a distinction. Because God anoints individuals, for example, Hazael, we just talked about. He's an anointed king of God. He doesn't obey God's Torah at all. But he's obeying God's will, even though he's not obeying the Torah. He's going off and killing a whole bunch of people. But he's obeying God's will. There's a difference. God does not live inside his Torah. He lives outside of it. He uses it to teach us. So you can obey God's will and not necessarily God's law, and vice versa. You can obey his law and not his will. We'll discuss that some other time. These two men were killed in the proper method, which means to me, they're obeying God's will in executing Joash for what Joash did. Yes, Sean.
I understand in that Romans says this is righteousness above the Torah. We know who that is. So,
yep.
But will he not break his own Torah as well, though?
Will he not break it? Explain it. What do you mean, he?
He will not go against his
God.
Own. Yeah.
God didn't kill these men.
No, I understand that. But even though he's the righteousness above it, he will not break it, though, at the same time.
Right. He didn't have to. He doesn't have to. There are many men who are anointed of God who are murderers. David's one. Now, he killed a lot of people, in case you weren't aware of that. He killed a lot of people. But he went against God's laws doing so. Yet he was still blessed or taken care of by God. Corrected for it. Punished for it. But still taken care of by him. So a will of God and the law of God are not necessarily always the same thing. Sometimes they're different. Hazael, as we just talked about, is an example of one. David, of course, was an example of another one. So you can contrast a human being and go against God's law, Hazael, but not to say God's will, killing off of northern tribe of Israel. David, going against God's law and God's will, by killing off Uriah, thank you, killing off Uriah and sleeping with his wife. Both of them were against God's law and God's will. But the punishment for David was his family. He would live to see all of his family be destroyed and taken apart by David's own command. Remember that David is the one who commanded this, that this would be the punishment. And God said, deal. Because David, remember when Nathan came to him and said, hey, what should happen to this man? He will take what's all of his and give it away. Guess what? So God said, I'll take what's all yours, David, and then give it to somebody else. Be careful what you say. Yes. So David went against God's law and his will, but God used David's own breaking of it to correct him for it. Brilliant. God's very smart. God didn't break any of his laws. Men did all this work.
And that's how you know the Bible's true. Because for one, why would you tell the story
Right. So I started out this chapter with a question, which was, what's Messiah's method for cleaning up God's house? Who did he, the king, ask to do the job first? The high priest and the other priests as well. Why? That's their building. What does it tell you about Messiah? What's Messiah's job when he comes to clean up? What is that? Clean up God's house first. What method is he going to use then to do so? What people? What's his first command? What was the first instruction? The Levites were, the priests were told to do so. What's Messiah's going to be his first instruction? Those of you who believe in me, follow Messiah, what are you going to do? The work. You're going to work. You can clean up God's house. Sharpen your tools.
Temple cleaners.
Yeah. The point is, respond the way that the king intended the high priest and the other priests to respond. That was the intention, that they do the work. So, expect that. You have work to do.
There is, but the spiritual menu you hinted on before, I talked about briefly that it has to do with the utensils and some of the details I don't want to go into today. I'm sorry, it's more complicated than what I can explain. It's very complex in its definitions. I talked briefly about it when I discussed when they were building Solomon's Temple, a couple years back I think it was. I might cover that again, but we'll see. It is posted on the internet, yes. It had to do with utensils and instruments. Any questions or comments? I cannot answer you the question.
Well, just like, let's say, for instance, for example, like, what was Israel?
Right, modern day Israel.
Modern day Israel. This is what's happening.
I will not comment on that too much. I know better than that. I will not take modern day interpretation of events, and politically or otherwise, and apply them to this story, because modern day interpretation, I have it in my head one way, and I've been wrong so many times, I'm done with having it my way. So now, I'm gonna just leave the political existing things off. Yes.
So then the cleaning up of the temple is this temple, or is it that temple?
It'd be your temple.
So,
but your temple, you are one part of it.
Okay, so when you say that our job is to clean up our temple, is our job is to clean up our character, our morals, or what we...
That is part of it. And let's go back to my example earlier. I changed rooms. I went back to the money room. Your job was to fix this corner. That's you.
So this is
that's your little corner. That's your job. But... that was this week's job. Your whole lifetime job is the entire room. So you start with you. You have a supporting role. Let's discuss... oh, I'm out of time. I shouldn't do this. Hold on a minute. If you recall Solomon's Temple, the way it was built, it was constructed in a very unique way. I mean, you can focus on the walls only. Just a really quick 10-second brief. So let's say we have a room here, a slightly larger room, a slightly larger room. First floor, second floor, third floor. This floor supports this wall. They support each other in the unique design. You're focused on here. You. What's above you? A brick. What are you in this corner? A brick. What's this one? A brick. Who's that? I don't know. Could be. The brick above him or her. Here's the one over here. And keep going all the way up. Oh, look, what's this whole room up here? Who's that? Well, guess what? There's a brick over this side too. You support everything above you to stand for, exactly, to stand for what God designed you to be. Fill in your brick and make sure your brick is strong. You have work to do. And you're helping, and this brick is helping, every brick above it.
So, they don't stop because they got the same two cars. The example of how you live your life.
Right, because by how you hold the bricks above you, or how you do your job, how you take care of what your task is, and not falter, don't show cracks, don't get weak with time, with weather, temperature, whatever. Don't go away. Right. Don't make your inside hollow. You could argue that if you were to the disgusting things we've watched on television or movies. Don't wipe those things. Don't weaken this part of you and you'll support what's above you. Now God's not likely to say, hey, you did a good job making a brick. I'm not going to make you into a tree. Don't, good luck with that. You don't. You don't change roles. God puts you in a role, you stay the role. So this job where he puts you, where you are in your life, in your cleaning up process, whatever it be, stay there and do a good job with it. Take what God gave you and do a really good job with it, and help everybody above you. Yes, Jeff.
Yeah, this is where the Apostle Paul riffed on this with the idea of the body, and each part of us have
right.
members of the body, and we can't just say, hey, I want to be some other part of the body. We're, right. we're assigned a certain part, and that's what the
do
role
it.
We're supposed to play, and
right.
you have to realize that it's all a part of the construction of the whole body.
Of the whole
body.
Thing, exactly. It's all part of it. Now, you are... In exactly this example, a body, a fingernail, a hair, whatever it may be, it's a small thing in the entire scheme of Solomon's Temple, which is huge. You are one little rock. Maybe you're not even a rock. Maybe you're the overlay of gold around the surface. Who cares what part you are? You're doing one function and do it well. That's how you stay clean. So when God comes and is examining for, as it quotes here, dilapidated sections, worn out areas, and he sees your square, he says, hey, that doesn't need repair. Your square is good. Let's move on to the next one. You understand what I mean? When Messiah comes and says, all right, I'm here to repair work, and here all this mess I got to repair, and sees you and says, oh, your square is doing good. You're clean the inside, clean the outside. Let's move on to the next square, and I'll work on that one now. And you, by the way, help support everything above you. Because you're standing on a whole lot of stuff beneath you, too. And you want to make sure he repairs every piece of it so you don't fall.
Are good yourself, and then you're doing the next job of repairing. Like, for example, let's say you're trying to work on your husband, and your husband refuses to follow what you follow, then he can use the justification, well, you're not supposed to judge me.
You know what judge means?
Not exactly.
judge is not, don't distinguish judge for discernment. There's a difference. Judge and discernment are different. When somebody, for example, you see a person of the street on the corner and flashing some business advertisement for a local somewhere to pick them up and pay for it, you can decide that I know what that is. I do not wish to live that life. That's discernment. This life is results in a going against God's laws for lots of reasons, and it results in a very awful existence. You were discerning. Are you saying that person should be killed for what they do? No. See, a judgment also includes condemnation, which means here is your sentence. It includes them saying, if you go to a judge, let's say you did a crime or were accused of one. You go to a judge, says, oh, you've done a crime. Say, okay, now go home. No. They say, you've done a crime. Here's your sentence. X number of months in jail. The judge does not just to say you've done a crime. There's also a sentence issued to you, a penalty you pay. Judgment includes condemnation as well, a corrective action being put upon someone.
The clarification is when Messiah said you should never call someone you fool, basically saying, you're going down in a burning ring of fire. That's
right.
You never say that to anybody. You are going straight down and you are condemned by God. Forget it. You're taking the straight, yes, the highway. No. Fool does not mean stupid. Fool, if you read in Proverbs, means someone who is completely detached from the thinking of God,
yeah,
and is heading
worthless.
Down the way to perdition.
Yeah,
so
worthless.
Kind of reread that Proverbs in the realm of, you know, when you see fool, that means someone who is, their thinking is going down the way towards, you know, away from God. It's not just, oh, you're ignorant. No, you're kind of dumb. No. You're making a judgment upon someone. That's why saying someone is a fool is
heavily condemned.
Hellfire.
Don't do that.
You're going to get it yourself. Because actually, what Messiah was saying is similar to what you say, what the Torah says about a false witness. By what sort of judgment you're saying that someone did falsely is what sentence you get. So that's why he says someone who said calls him you fool is in danger of hellfire, because that's what judgment you were putting upon that person to begin with. Saying you are destined for hellfire, which is something that is not in your purview to judge, so thus you get the hellfire.
And David's the example of did exactly that. Yeah. That is wrong. That is wrong to do. Right.
One of the things that at the time of Moses that has been discussed often is that Moses hit the rock and then God was mad,
right.
And he didn't go in the kingdom and into the land. And that is the common looking at it. But there's another component to it that we've discussed, and the fact that God says, you didn't honor me. And at that time, when he hit the rock, he was saying, you, paraphrased, you dumb people, you right. get it all wrong, you're worthless. I don't know why God isn't even going to mess with you. You're worthless.
Do we have done wrong for you?
Yes. We're you're just not worth much. And what he could have said, which is a real, I've had teenagers, it is a real easy thing when your kids just really do so much wrong that you can say, that person is, I quit. That person's worthless. That is this kind of danger. And then you look back and say, okay, Moses, turn it around. What, me as a mom or a grandmother, what would I say that's opposite of that? I would say, all right, you kids, you're worthless. You did everything wrong, but God is bigger. God will save you around, out of, and away from your sins because God wins the battle. And that turns a curse into hope. Because I have offspring that are not right, and I just push it away. I pray for them, and I wait. Because, see, when I talk to them, hey, you can do your own dumb thing. You can destroy your life. But you know what, kiddo? God wins the battle. So you can battle as young as you want because God wins. That is what honors God. And when we deal with our kids, we can say, yeah, well, that's not going to help much, but, hey, guys, God wins.
I am way over time. Actually, I kept you all the way past Shabbat. Shabbat ended. So I'm going to say have a good rest of your Shabbat, but Shabbat's already done. Any questions or comments? Shabbat Tov. Have a good week. Thank you.